for Buchanan, Price, and St. Clair. But Ziegler persisted. He needed to be absolutely certain to verify their thesis personally. Although Haig thought it was a waste of time, he agreed to a meeting with Bohl and Buzhardt that evening at the White House. He called Bohl, but he was not at the White House. It was about 6 p.m. when he was finally located. "I'm leaving Camp David shortly, and I would like to see you and Jerry Jones in my office at 8, Haig told him. Jones was responsible for the record-keeping of the tapes. As Bohl got ready to go back to the White House, he received another call, this time from the president. How sure was Bohl that he, Nixon, had listened to the tape on May 6th?
Quite certain.
Are you sure? The president demanded.
I thought it was later.
Impossible, said Bohl. It was in the notes.
Was it possible that Bohl had cued that tape, but that the president had not listened to it?
No, Mr. President. I remember the day well. The tape counter indicated that the president had actually listened to the tape, not just that the machine had been set up.
There was no question, Bohl assured him.
When Bohl arrived at the White House, no one but Jones was there, but soon the party from Camp David returned. Buzhardt walked into Haig's office with them. Haig asked Jones when the president had received the June 23rd tape. It had been checked out to Bohl on May 6th. Haig turned to Bohl. When did he listen to it? As Bohl was rechecking his notes, Price said to him, "It's very important."
"It might be fatal," Haig added.
Bohl looked at his interrogators.
"My notes show that the president heard it on May 6th.
"Who knows about it?" Haig asked.
Bohl had told it to the grand jury when he testified on June 6th. He had also turned over his notes. Bohl expected Haig to be angry with him. He was not. Haig paused. Everybody waited.
"Okay, that's it," he said. "An act probably fatal."
His tone was resigned. There was nothing more to discuss. Ziegler had stopped arguing. After Bohl and Jones had left, the others went back to Price's draft. Haig handed Buzhardt a copy and then filled him in on how things had gone at Camp David. The president was insisting that he had not listened to the tape and that he wanted the statement to back him up. Haig's face asked, "Can you believe that?" Buzhardt shook his head, sadly. The statement could not say that the president had not listened to the tape because the notes said the opposite and both the special prosecutor and the grand jury had the notes. The group worked toward what they hoped would be an acceptable compromise. Price could write that the president had reviewed the tapes in May, but would not say precisely when. That might be enough. It would skirt the issue. For Haig and St. Clair, though, that was not enough. They insisted that the president say that he had not told them at the time what was on the tape. St. Clair was determined that the president also take responsibility for withholding that tape from the special prosecutor and the House Judiciary Committee. They were talking to the president through Ziegler. The president had to stop denying facts that were already on record, and he had to clarify their situation once and for all. Buzhardt thought Haig and St. Clair were coming close to threatening to resign. He tried to calm them. Quietly, he reminded them that they had all agreed not to do anything to force a resignation, that a resignation had to be a willing act on the president's part, that Nixon, above all, must see it as such. Price would work something out, Buzhardt assured them. Haig and St. Clair relented. The discussion turned to how to work out the two-step strategy. What had to be done the next day? Who would have to be briefed before the transcript hit? Haig began making calls right after the meeting. He reached Treasury Secretary William Simon and told him, "I've got bad news. It may be fatal to the president." He described the transcript. There would also be a statement by the president offering his explanation, but that was still in the works. Haig's frustration boiled over as he told Simon what had to be included in the statement. Buzhardt, St. Clair, and he were all resigning if the president doesn't lay it on the line.
Monday, August 5th. Haig arrived at the White House early.
He had been through this exercise many times, getting the difficult word out, letting the right people know in the right order so that nobody was needlessly offended. Haig made and held friends that way. He had mastered the mechanics of telling the bureaucratic and political establishments about presidential decisions slightly in advance, giving them enough time to absorb the facts, but not enough to spread them around. Today was delicate. This maneuver called for perfect timing. The new transcript could not be allowed to cause a panic, but its significance must not be lost. That was the key to the two-step plan. The president's degree of culpability had to sink in slowly but deeply. This time, Nixon didn't have a grand gesture in reserve to distract the country or to explain away the obvious. No speech, as with Vietnam, the Haldeman-Ehrlichman resignations, or the release of the edited transcripts. Today, Haig was on his own. It was crucial that warning be given to the 10 Republican supporters on the House Judiciary Committee who had gone to the mat for the president, to the Senate Republican leaders, to key Democratic friends like Eastland and Stennis, to Jaworski, to George Bush, the cabinet, and the hard-pressed White House staff. Haig would handle the staff personally. Reporters would be given the statement and transcript late in the afternoon, time enough to grasp what was in them but too late to set off a stampede. On the Hill, members could ponder and consult before they went out front or issued any statements. That way the drama would be played out over a few days. Those who had seen the transcript were of one mind. Even so, Haig couldn't be absolutely sure of the wider response. The consensus of the president's senior staff, Ziegler, Buzzard, St. Clair, Price, Buchanan, Birch himself, had often been wrong. The reactions of Wiggins and Griffin might be signs that the matter was clinched. Still, he had to move carefully, preserve his position with the president, and let others draw the conclusions. He would sit tight in the middle and convey his feelings by simply failing to come forward with his usual and expected support of the president. Haig had watched the president weather hurricanes before. Nixon might just pull out of this one. There were hidden resources in the man, and immense power in the office. Haig was acutely aware of that. He doubted there was another rallying cry in Richard Nixon, but he couldn't be sure. Even now, he really didn't have any confidence that he knew the president very well. When Buzzard arrived at Haig's office very early, George Bush was already there, briefed and somewhat relieved. Finally, there was some one thing the national chairman could see clearly. The ambiguities in the evidence against the president had been tearing the party apart, Bush thought. The three men reviewed the day's plan. Buzzard and Dean Birch would lay the situation out that afternoon for John Rhodes. That was sensitive. The press was expecting Rhodes to announce today whether he would assume leadership of the anti-impeachment forces. Haig had warned him off, but it was crucial to take Rhodes's temperature carefully. Haig needed consensus. The president's friends, certain trusted aides, a few politicians whose motives could not be suspect, must come succinctly to a single conclusion. He didn't want his ass out front alone. He didn't want his ass out front, period. There wouldn't be any attempt to strong-arm Rhodes, but Buzzard was confident that he could help Rhodes see what was now the only solution. Bush asked to go along. It would have been impolite to refuse. Shortly after 9:15 a.m., Birch, Timmons, Buchanan, Lichtenstein, Clausen, and Richard Moore gathered in Birch's office to be briefed by Buchanan. He described the weekend at Camp David. Price, St. Clair, and he stuck off in one cabin, Nixon in another, and Haig and Ziegler running back and forth with messages. The president saying that the transcript didn't mean what it said, and then the president's senior aides conducting their own investigation of the president to confirm that he had listened to the tape. Buchanan was rubbing his hands, rocking back and forth in his chair, trying to articulate what he felt after almost 10 years of service to Richard Nixon. He brooded about how hard he and the others had worked on the defense, how he had persistently maintained that the old man was a victim. Not without his faults, but a victim. Buchanan seemed on the verge of boiling over again. The old man had lied to him and everybody else. He had connived. The president had listened to the tape 3 months earlier, in May. He had known since then that it confirmed the worst suspicions, and he had canceled the proposed compromise with Jaworski because of it. The family, Julie in particular, was pressuring the president not to resign. But Buchanan was clear in his own mind. It was over, he said. He called down to the legal offices for a copy of the transcript. Jeff Shepard was shaking when he went off to the Xerox machine. This is it, he told Ann Morgan, Gergen's assistant. They found the smoking gun. Then he took the copy up to Birch's office and read it aloud. When Shepard had finished reading, Clausen said to Lichtenstein, Unfortunately, there isn't a market for right-wing journalists. The group had never organized strategy effectively. Now they could at least register its collapse. Somebody get the ice, Birch said. Someone got the scotch. To the president, Timmons toasted. It was a perfectly serious moment. Hail and farewell. Soon Timmons was on the phone. Come on over. We're writing resumes, he said to one of his assistants. Briefly, Timmons worried about whether Haig had contacted all the key people. Dean, does Bush know about the transcript yet? Yes. Well, what did he do? He broke out into assholes and shit himself to death, Birch replied. In his Houston law office that morning, Leon Jaworski was told that General Haig was on the line. Jaworski was in Texas to arrange his finances. Now that he was on a considerably reduced government salary of about $40,000 a year, he wanted to move some of his money around for income tax purposes. Haig was less than forthright. He described the new transcript, claiming that neither he nor the lawyers had known it existed until just now. It came as a shocker, he said. St. Clair got on the line. It's got to be turned over. I've made contrary representations to the House Judiciary Committee. Jaworski heard their nervousness, particularly St. Clair's. The president's attorney was not only informing the special prosecutor, he was protecting himself, getting it on the record that he had insisted on release. In 7 months of dealing with St. Clair, Jaworski had concluded that the Boston lawyer was overrated. It was clear that he lacked information and was not in control of the Nixon defense. Jaworski had come to regard him as simply another component of the White House public relations machine, another aide proclaiming presidential innocence. The new tape was not a surprise. Jaworski had expected something like it. It sounded harmful to the president's defense, but there had already been so much. He saw no reason to rush back to Washington. The president returned from Camp David by helicopter at 10 o'clock. As he was landing, Ziegler sent Connie Girard to Price's office to pick up an envelope, instructing her not to read what was inside. In any case, Price had taken the unusual precaution of sealing it with tape. She took the package to Stuart Stout in the usher's office in the residence, and he delivered it to the president. It contained Price's 8-page fourth draft of the afternoon's statement. As the president was reviewing it, St. Clair called McCahill into his office. It was about 11 a.m. The June 23rd tape has some very damaging stuff on it, St. Clair said. He told him the details. McCahill agreed it was bad. Do you think I ought to resign? St. Clair asked. McCahill was taken aback. The young lawyers on the team often joked about bombshells making direct hits on their bunker. I'm getting out of here, one would say to another. Sometimes they'd joke that the special prosecutor was going to name Buzzard as an unindicted co-conspirator. But St. Clair was deadly serious. He was telling his associate that their client had withheld evidence. McCahill was trying to think. His first reactions to difficult disclosures had always been, okay, how do we explain it? Where is the justification? Let's look at it. Oddly, St. Clair and McCahill had never discussed whether they thought the president was innocent. They were busy lawyers. They had just pushed on with a defense. McCahill used to say to St. Clair that working in the White House was like shaving in the dark. He had gone so far as to urge St. Clair to ask the president what defense he thought they should deploy, since he knew the facts and the lawyers were only speculating. But St. Clair had reminded him that the president had other matters to deal with than building a legal defense, and McCahill had accepted the rules. Now, his boss was asking whether he should resign. McCahill said no, not under the circumstances. In an ordinary case, perhaps, but St. Clair's resignation would leave the president without a lawyer. McCahill would, of course, resign too if St. Clair did, and so probably would the rest of the legal staff. The president of the United States might not be able to get a lawyer. St. Clair, still holding back details of the statement drafted for Nixon, mused that he might be able to get the president to say publicly that the lawyers had not been aware of this new evidence. McCahill wondered out loud if the president was going to resign. "As far as I know," St. Clair said, "we're going to trial in the Senate." "Well then," McCahill replied, "I have work to do." He wanted to attempt a full analysis of the transcript, but before that, he had to go to Sirica's courtroom once again. Benveniste wanted to subpoena the secretaries who had transcribed some of the tapes to determine if there were any more gaps. On the flight back to Washington that morning, Senator Robert Griffin was pondering the impact, if any, of his Saturday letter. Not enough, he decided, and he got out his yellow legal pad and a blue felt-tipped pen. At 11:30, after attending a closed Rules Committee hearing on the procedures that would govern the Senate trial, Griffin read his statement to reporters on Capitol Hill. He spoke in a low, somber voice. "I think we've arrived at a point where both the national interest and his own interest would be best served by resigning. It's not just his enemies who feel that way. Many of his friends, and I count myself one of them, believe now that this would be the most appropriate course. Needless to say, this would be an awesome and very difficult decision for him to reach, but I believe that he will see it that way too." The number two Republican in the Senate had called for resignation and had predicted that the president himself would agree that it was the best course. At the White House, the daily briefing was already 2 hours overdue when Gerald Warren entered the press room at 1 p.m. to announce that there would be another two-hour delay. Ziegler called his staff into his small office, Diane Sawyer, Jerry Warren, Judy Johnson, Connie Girard, Karen Nordstrom, and Frank Gannon. "I just want to tell you guys what's happened." His manner was calm, cool, sad, but not apologetic. "We are going to put out some material this afternoon that some of you will be shocked by. You'll be typing a statement by the president. Accompanying it will be three transcripts of presidential conversations." His tone was formal. "There is a problem because while Mr. St. Clair was making certain statements, the president acknowledges he knew otherwise about what Mr. St. Clair was saying. All I can think about why this has happened this way is that the president didn't focus on the entire problem. Each one of you can draw your own conclusion as to what it means. I firmly believe that the president forgot he had said that and forgot that he had heard that tape. A lot of people would be calling for the president's resignation," Ziegler said, "and many in the White House would be disappointed and hurt." Ziegler himself had personally agonized over the situation, but he recognized that a president could have human frailties. A 61-year-old man with a lot of responsibilities could listen to a tape and not discuss it because he did not want to focus on it or its implications. Judy Johnson was crying. "We'll have no more tears," Ziegler said. "We'll be professional and do our job like we always have." He asked that they hold the information confidential until it was released. Ann Greer had left the White House to look for a record during her lunch hour. When she came back, the press offices were empty and Ziegler's door was shut. When everybody finally emerged, Greer had trouble finding out what had happened. Diane Sawyer was saying, "My God, I can't believe all this is in here. Can you believe it?" She told Greer that Ron would see her privately in a few minutes. but Ziegler got tied up, and Greer went back to Sawyer. A June 23rd transcript was going to be released, Sawyer explained, and it was bad.
What is so bad about it?
What is so bad about it is that the president said something on the tape, and he has been letting St. Clair go out and say one thing which he knows is not so. Ron's explanation is that the president was too beat to understand what he heard, and he wasn't focusing on what St. Clair was doing. Greer thought, well, the president is a little bit guilty, but certainly not as guilty as some people think. But Karen Nordstrom interjected, what bullshit! Does he really expect us to believe this? Soon the president's statement had been mimeographed and the transcript retyped on bond paper to be Xeroxed. Johnson, Greer, and Nordstrom fanned out to the Xerox machines. The delay in the briefing had alerted the press, and more reporters were arriving at the White House. The press room was jammed, the overflow group spilling onto the lawn in front of the West Wing entrance. Several reporters lay on the grass, which was forbidden. Tom DeCare thought the press was waiting for blood. Reporters were flouting regulations and decorum because they sensed the end. Ziegler reassured him. They had had tough times before and had made it through. There was no mention of resignation. Warren had almost stopped functioning. Ziegler told him that the problem now was to help the president survive his personal anguish. John Rhodes stayed home. The cover story for delaying his press conference was that he was ill, and it would be best to play it through. Wiggins had called him at about 8:30 that morning to describe the contents of the tape. A number of reporters visited Rhodes' house to try to get a statement. CBS correspondent Leslie Stahl rang the doorbell, and Rhodes' wife answered. She thought Stahl was the Avon lady. At about 1:15 p.m., Buzzard, Birch, and Bush arrived at Rhodes' home. Buzzard told the minority leader they had a little bomb. Little, but highly explosive. Rhodes' wife, Betty, served iced tea because it was too early for the scotch Rhodes felt like having. They sat down in the living room, and Rhodes read the excerpts. There was a brief silence as he laid the sheets aside.
This is incredible.
Yes, Buzzard agreed. It was to me, too. This means that there's just no chance in the world that he's not going to be impeached, said Rhodes. In fact, there's no chance in the world that I won't vote to impeach him. Buzzard sighed his relief.
I certainly can understand that, Birch said.
You know, Rhodes continued, it'd be better to get this thing over to the Senate just as rapidly as possible because there's no profit to the country or anybody in dragging this out in the House.
If you've got any chance at all, which I doubt, it's over in the Senate.
After the beating he had taken several months earlier when he had suggested that the president resign, Rhodes was not about to mention resignation again, even in private, even to the president's closest assistants. The three men left, satisfied. The consensus was taking hold. Rhodes later let it be known that he was offended that Bush had been briefed before he was. At 3 p.m., in room H-138 of the House of Representatives, the Judiciary Committee Democrats caucused. Rodino announced that he hoped the impeachment debate on the House floor would begin in 2 weeks, on August 19th. He proposed 75 hours of general debate. At 3:30 p.m., across the street in the office of Leslie C. Ahrens of Illinois, the number two House Republican, the president's defenders on the committee met at Timmons' invitation. St. Clair and Timmons were beginning their briefing when Buzzard and Birch arrived. This audience knew the case intimately, so the effect of the new transcript was immediate. Their reactions ranged from outrage to dismay. Their calls for specificity now held a terrible irony. St. Clair defended himself to them. He had been ready to resign if the president had opposed release, he said. St. Clair failed to mention that he had learned of the new evidence on July 24th, the day the Judiciary Committee debate had opened on television. The congressional defenders focused their anger on Nixon. St. Clair, Buzzard, and Timmons moved on to Scott's office for a meeting with the Senate Republican leaders, Scott, Griffin, Tower, Brock, and Norris Cotton of New Hampshire. Scott's office was decorated as a sitting room with a desk stuck off in a corner, oriental art on the walls, and small Chinese figurines on the mantle. A large chandelier hung from the high ceiling. The senators sat stiffly on gold brocade couches, while St. Clair told them that once again, he was the bearer of bad news. Scott interrupted. He was worried that the White House was trying again to divide the Republicans, and asked if John Rhodes had been informed. He became slightly less suspicious when told that Rhodes knew. The clock on the mantel showed just after 4 p.m. St. Clair was watching it. He said he had a new transcript that was bad, and it was being released publicly right at that moment. Copies were handed around. St. Clair said that he had insisted it be released. I told the president that if it weren't, he'd be minus a lawyer. No one said anything, as the five senators read. I've had a problem as a lawyer, whether I could continue as the president's lawyer, St. Clair said when they had finished. But as long as he released it, he has done his part, and I can continue to do my best to make a defense. He had thought he had the case won, until this last tape, he said.
Where?
Scott inquired. The other senators, especially Tower, echoed his doubt. St. Clair didn't really answer. He had heard from Haig that senatorial skepticism about Watergate was a localized infection in and around Scott's office. The senators were not nearly as familiar with the case as the Republican members of the House Judiciary Committee, but the transcript's significance couldn't be missed.
This changes the picture one more time, Scott said.
The meeting ended politely. Scott thought it odd that the White House representatives hadn't even tried to defend what was on the tape. While Buzzard, St. Clair, Timmons, and Birch were on the Hill, about 100 White House staffers assembled in a fourth-floor auditorium in the EOB. Chuck Wardell had been instructed to summon Haig when the room was filled. Every seat was taken, and people stood in the aisles. Haig was delayed because he was still notifying the cabinet members. Housing and Urban Development Secretary James Lynn had been tracked down in the barber shop. Staff members in the EOB were silent as Haig entered, half an hour late. The blue curtains were closed behind him, and he stood on a podium speaking into a microphone. There was the clipped, efficient ring of the general in his voice.
Thank you for coming. I have the tough task of bringing you some bad news. The president has been reviewing tapes. All except one are consistent with his previous explanations. The exception is of sufficient gravity to warrant a briefing, and that is the tape of June 23, 1972.
The House committee, the special prosecutor, and Judge Sirica had been informed, Haig assured them. The tape shows that previous explanations have been incomplete and erroneous as regards CIA involvement. I know the transcript makes it difficult again for you and the president. He hoped they all would stay at their desks. If not out of loyalty to the president, then out of loyalty to the nation. I have served with men in combat, and I can say that no men and women have ever been as brave as this White House staff. Haig then read the president's statement, acknowledging that the transcript was at variance with earlier statements. Though the president had listened to the tapes in May, he had not realized the implications and hadn't bothered to inform anyone.
This was a serious act of omission for which I take full responsibility and which I deeply regret, Haig read.
I recognize that this additional material I am now furnishing may further damage my case, especially because attention will be drawn separately to it rather than to the evidence in its entirety. Whatever mistakes I made in the handling of Watergate, the basic truth remains that when all the facts were brought to my attention, I insisted on a full investigation and prosecution of those guilty.
I am firmly convinced that the record in its entirety does not justify the extreme step of impeachment and removal of a president. I trust that as the constitutional process goes forward, this perspective will prevail.
As Haig walked off the stage, the audience rose and applauded. Then, suddenly, the room was silent. In the quiet, the staff had time to ponder Haig's words. If not out of loyalty to the president, then out of loyalty to the nation. it was hard for many of them to gauge the situation. It seemed clear that the president was determined to fight, and the president's statement ended on an upbeat note. Yet Haig's demeanor and tone were not aggressive, as they had always been in the past. The staffers filed out slowly. Many appeared unsure of what to do next. Watergate veterans were anxious to get copies of the transcript. Presidential explanations had a tendency to mask the gravity of the disclosures. This time, Haig's appeal had not touched Buzzard's assistant, Dick Hauser. He went back to his office and wrote out his resignation. "When you're a lawyer," he told Pam Dallas, "you expect your client to lie to you. But not when he is the president." He tried several versions, long and short, and spent the rest of the afternoon on the phone seeking advice from friends. Months earlier, when Hauser had been trying to decide whether to come to work for the president, Buzzard had told him, "I'm going to come out of this fine. I've been through worse. The president is going to come out okay, and if I come out okay, so will you." Now Hauser was convinced that he had made a mistake, and he was going to rectify it. He went to see Buzzard. Normally, Buzzard would have attempted to dissuade him. Today, he just didn't have the time. Ken Cole, chief domestic affairs advisor to the president, called his staff together in his second-floor suite and said that if some of them couldn't take it, he would understand if they resigned. But if they stayed, he said, he expected them to work full-time to keep the government functioning. Cole himself was in a slow burn at having been deceived. Many among the staff were distraught. Bill Henkel took a copy of the transcript, and when he reached his office, he grunted, "Fuck," and flung it across the room. Gergen and Agnes Waldron, the head of the research office, went up to McCahill and offered their sympathy. It seemed worse for the lawyers. The usual reaction in the White House to moments of crisis was to call meetings. Juwan gathered a group of middle-level staffers in the Roosevelt Room, among them Gergen, Jones, Powell Moore, Ken Kachigian, and David Parker. The group was first given the two shorter transcripts of June 23, 1972, and for 15 minutes they read and wondered what all the fuss was about. Then they were given the text of Nixon's initial meeting that day with Haldeman. It was 34 pages long. Gergen and Parker were astounded at the contents, looking at each other as they tried to absorb one shock after another. Everyone was reading portions aloud. "Did you see this? Did you see that?" There were protests. The president talking about Herb Klein. "He doesn't have his head screwed on right." The president not giving a shit about the lira. The arts, you know, they're Jews, they're left wing. In other words, stay away. The coiffures of his wife and daughters. The helicopter destroys their hair and so forth. Why were these things left in? Could it be stopped? Now Juwan realized that Haig, Ziegler, and the lawyers had dropped their public relations guard in the rush to get the material out. He ran out of the meeting and burst into the press office, insisting that the release be stopped. It was too late. More than 100 copies had been distributed. It was unthinkable to recall them and then hand out an expurgated version. Juwan returned to the Roosevelt Room. The discussion had a feeling of aimlessness and gloom. Small groups of staffers gathered all over the White House and the EOB, talking in low voices. Work had virtually ceased. Wayne Vallis, an assistant to William Baruti, a political counselor to the president, got a copy of the transcript from the press office, took it back to Baruti's EOB office, and read it aloud. Someone asked how many votes the president would now have on the Hill. "There won't be any votes. Don't you see?" Baruti said. Tom Corologos took refuge in humor, parroting Senator Howard Baker's often repeated question during the Watergate hearings the year before. Corologos asked, "What did the president know, and when did he know it?" "He sure found out." Bruce Hershenson, a former United States Information Agency official who had been brought to the White House by Haldeman to write administration propaganda, had missed the Haig briefing, but he was soon getting reports. Haig had not defended the president this time. Something had changed. Hershenson placed a call to Haig. It was not returned. He read the June 23rd transcripts and the president's statement. Something odd was going on, he concluded. He found the statement more damaging than the transcripts. He went over them again. The transcripts were defensible, or at the least ambiguous. They could be read either way. The national security considerations were real, even though the president had not referred to them specifically in his conversations with Haldeman. Certainly a freewheeling investigation of Watergate the week after the break-in would have led to the plumbers and to the important work of stopping news leaks. There was also a human factor, a president protecting his aides and friends. Upstairs in the EOB, Lawrence Higbee took a call from his former boss, H.R. Haldeman, who had heard the news. "Why had so much been conceded?" Haldeman asked. Higbee told him that the resignation pressure was mounting and that it appeared that the president might succumb.
"I think you're right," Haldeman said. "He'll do it. If he does, it's a mistake. If he does it, the problem is how he does it."
The former White House chief of staff, due to go on trial soon in the Watergate cover-up, was worried about his own papers and Nixon's tapes. What would happen to them if Nixon left?
"If he's going to pay the price and resign, he ought to end Watergate," Haldeman said.
And that would include settling the issue of the tapes once and for all. Nixon ought to get control of them, and also grant pardons to everyone. He could also give pardons to the Vietnam deserters. That would make amnesty more acceptable to the anti-Nixon, anti-war crowd. Ben Stein had listened with shock to Haig's presentation, and was wandering around, expressing wonderment that Watergate had come to this. Ray Price needed time to work on the resignation address, and he needed to keep Stein busy. He assigned him to write a fight speech. "Here's your chance to do something great," Price instructed. "Write a speech that will bring tears to the eyes of Americans and demands that the president stay in office." Stein took to his typewriter with the old enthusiasm. Price had watched the president waver on the question of resignation, but he was sure that in the end Nixon would resign. He raised the matter with his friend Len Garment. Garment, regarded by his colleagues as the best resident analyst of the Nixon psyche, was sure the president would stick it out. They bet a dinner on it. On the House floor, Barbara Conable watched Wiggins and his allies on Judiciary coming in, looking very gray. It was the signal he was waiting for. John Rhodes had called at 3:45 to warn him. "You were the only member of the leadership that I care about," Rhodes had said, "and you may want to protect yourself." Now Conable walked to the TV cameras and took protective steps. "If the transcripts are as Nixon says, I will vote for impeachment on Article 1. I don't approve of leaders who mislead." Wiggins then went before the cameras with a prepared statement. His eyes were damp, and the confident punch was absent from his voice. His torment was visible and moving, and his directness gave dignity to the moment of humiliation. "I have reached the painful conclusion that the President of the United States should resign," Wiggins said, struggling to speak. "If the President did not resign, I am prepared to conclude that the magnificent career of public service of Richard Nixon must be terminated involuntarily." Of the 10 defenders, only Wiggins and Iowa Congressman Wiley Mayne shifted positions publicly that afternoon. The others said they would reassess. John Anderson, the liberal third-ranking Republican, also hesitated. Since calling on the president to resign 3 months earlier, he had learned to move more slowly. The Senate Republican leadership issued a one-sentence statement from Scott's office. "The president took the proper action in releasing essential additional information prior to the House vote." Rabbi Korf reacted strongly. He wanted to see the president, but he hadn't been able to get through all day. After a long wait in the first floor usher's office, Korf was taken to see David Eisenhower in the solarium. The rabbi's message was to fight. David told him there was a good chance that the president would resign. Then David walked to the Lincoln sitting room, where the president had again taken refuge, and relayed Korf's message. The president didn't want to see Korf. He didn't seem interested in the statement that had just been released. Richard Nixon did not look at his son-in-law. He expressed sadness that his staff, Haig, St. Clair, Buzzard and Buchanan were not more like Korf.
It would be nice to have them sticking by at this moment, the president said. But he didn't blame them.
Julie hurried to the East Wing to do some organizing. The family was going out on the Sequoia in a little while, and she wanted to have as many female staffers as possible outside to cheer her father as he departed the White House. At 5:15 p.m., Mrs. Nixon, David, Julie, Rosemary Woods, and the president emerged through the diplomatic entrance. Nixon was wearing a light blue sports jacket. He looked old. About 50 secretaries were gathered along the driveway. At first, Nixon seemed surprised and embarrassed. He began joking awkwardly with David about all the pretty girls.
He would have liked all these girls around when he was in the Navy, he said.
And David and Julie laughed. Mrs. Nixon tried to look cheerful, smiling and kissing some good friends on the staff.
"We still love you,"
one of the staffers said. The remark was repeated more than once, and there was some applause. Julie had wanted to make it a campaign send-off, and for a moment it was almost as if nothing had happened. 15 minutes later, the family boarded the Sequoia. Lieutenant Commander Coombs decided to go downriver. He thought the president would not want to see people. As they passed the National War College, Nixon said,
"Imagine George Patton riding around the courtyard."
The movie Patton was his favorite, and he had shown it at the White House several times. He began reminiscing again, recalling how the family had gone to Haynes Point for picnics when the girls were little, and he began talking about his presidency in the past tense.
"It has been fun having use of the yacht," he said.
A few minutes before 7 p.m., Julwan called an expanded group of middle-level staffers together. Parker said the president should hold a cabinet meeting. Speaks thought the new disclosures were insignificant and ambiguous.
Kachigian
and he wanted to fight on. Gergen and Jerry Jones said the only honorable thing was to resign. Most of the others were restrained, doubtful of the wisdom of expressing themselves frankly. Except for Anne Morgan.
"George, you're a soldier," she told Julwan. "You can't keep sending your soldiers out without ammunition."
The White House mess was closed, so arrangements were made for sandwiches to be sent in. Ziegler poked his head in nervously, but he didn't say anything. Inside Haig's office, St. Clair and Buzzard were giving the general a rundown on the Hill briefings. The reaction had been severe, the lawyers agreed. St. Clair said he had told the congressman he would have resigned had the transcripts not been released. Buzzard thought St. Clair was grandstanding. His threat to resign had never been made to the president, and Nixon, in any case, had never seriously considered withholding the transcripts. Haig turned on the evening news. All three major networks devoted between 13 and 17 minutes to the new evidence, but the reactions seemed milder than Haig had expected, the language muted. Walter Cronkite of CBS and John Chancellor of NBC referred to a storm in the nation's capital and said the president had stunned the country. But CBS concluded that whether the tape was a smoking gun would be left to the Senate. United Press International led with the president's acknowledgment that he had acted to slow the FBI investigation, not necessarily to thwart it. The House was lost, unquestionably. Probably the Senate, too, though the meaning of the reaction there was difficult to gauge. Only Griffin was calling for resignation. Goldwater and Stennis had not commented. Senator Curtis did not agree that the president should resign. Senator Strom Thurmond of South Carolina stated that if the president was convinced of his innocence, he should fight it to the last. Senator Edward M. Kennedy agreed that the country would best be served by continuation of the constitutional process. After the news, Haig turned to Buzzard.
"Maybe we were wrong," he said. "Was acquittal still possible?"
Haig had a perplexed look on his face. The president, waiting aboard the Sequoia for word of the congressional reaction, left the table just before dessert to talk with Haig by ship-to-shore phone. The general made his report as pessimistic as possible.
"To hell with those soft bastards in the House," Nixon said. "He would concede the House and prevail in the Senate."
Haig said he didn't think the president could win in the Senate now. The subject of resignation was not even up for discussion, as far as the president was concerned. He was holding to his decision to fight to the finish. He hung up and went to sit alone on the covered fantail. Julie joined him a few minutes later.
"I'm getting bad news," he said.
The trip was supposed to have been a pep session to fortify her father. He looked broken. It was the president's custom to shake Lieutenant Commander Coombs' hand only as he boarded the Sequoia. But this evening, as the ship docked back at the Navy Yard just after 7:30, he paused to shake hands again with the skipper.
"It has been wonderful," he said solemnly.
Mrs. Nixon said so too.
"It has been nice," Julie added.
After reporting to the president, Haig went to the Roosevelt Room. Jiuwan was reviewing recommendations with the strategy group. Haig announced a cabinet meeting for the next day.
"The president will not resign," he said. "That is his decision, and we have to do what he wants to do. This is not a kamikaze mission."
In his stern but friendly manner, Haig discouraged any expression of contrary views. Bozart could feel the power evaporating. It was urgent that they have a plan, a timetable. The vice president must be kept in town. Ford was scheduled for a California speaking tour at the end of the week. Vice President Ford had said that afternoon that he was taking himself out of the impeachment issue entirely and would not comment anymore. Then he went home. Robert Hartman reached him there and offered to describe the transcripts. Ford said he had a general idea of what they contained. He would wait for the morning papers. After the Sequoia outing, Ben Stein called Julie.
"You ought to be prepared for really bad things," he said. "The end is near. You have a lot of talent and ought to be thinking about a life for yourself."
"Do you think he should resign?" she asked.
"If his health can take it," Stein replied, "he should not resign.
The president's tormentors should be left with as much blood on their hands as possible," he said. Still, there was no doubt the president would be convicted in the Senate.
"It doesn't matter about his health," Julie said. "His whole life is ruined."
Her voice was sad, but she did not cry. She said that her father had wanted to resign, but it was her impression that the family had succeeded in talking him out of it. It was important that he stay and fight, to make his enemies aware of what they had done. So in future years, they'll see they were wrong, and that will make them not do it again.
"Well," Stein said, "he's a great man. A great, great man."
Julie and David stayed up very late that night talking. The president was also up late. He had Sanchez prepare an early breakfast for him before he retired around 4 a.m. Haig had taken calls most of the night, making sure that cabinet members were informed of the meeting in the morning. Buchanan, Richard Moore, and Father McLaughlin had hung around, drinking scotch. McLaughlin, embarrassed by the appearance of new evidence, was painting a picture of himself as the victim of a monstrous prevarication. In his Northwest Washington apartment that night, Goldwater was unable to sleep. Dean Birch had delivered a copy of the transcripts to him late in the afternoon. Goldwater was appalled with himself for having put up with Richard Nixon as long as he had. He knew that the president, the press, and Congress all regarded him as a sort of litmus test of Nixon's chances for survival. Tomorrow, he would have to figure out what to do. The press office had been deserted since mid-evening. Reporters had been assured that nothing more would happen that day. Occasionally a phone would ring. The wire service machines rattled continuously. In a 1,500-word advance, Frank Cormier of the Associated Press had written, "Once hailed as a political miracle worker, Richard M. Nixon has seen his election triumphs reduced to ashes, leaving many wondering if he really did have that sure touch for politics."
The street in front of the White House was almost deserted. Occasionally, a car with an out-of-town license plate would swing over to the curb on Pennsylvania Avenue, slow to a few miles an hour as the occupants gawked, and then accelerate into the night. There was nothing to see. Two young men with knapsacks on their backs stepped up to the guard at the gate.
"Where can we get passports?" one asked.
"Right there," the guard said,
pointing across Lafayette Park down several blocks to the passport office, but they won't open until 9. Inside, a janitor was on his rounds. In the press office, he scooped up the stacks of releases and swept them into a large trash barrel.
Tuesday, August 6th. Back at his desk on Tuesday morning, Haig called those members of the cabinet who still had not been informed of the meeting. It was perhaps the least of his priorities. Today, Haig had to cope with the Hill and the Nixon family. With events closing in, Haig was aware that he could easily get mousetrapped. A basic element of the scenario seemed to be failing. Each time the president heard that somebody on the Hill was calling for his resignation, he became more resolved to fight to the finish. His tirades were always the same. He would not be forced out by some legislative coup. If they wanted him out of office, let them vote to impeach and convict. Nixon still was not certain that he would lose in the Senate. Haig and Buzhardt had discussed the problem again last night. They agreed that it was crucial that no more Republican leaders call for the president's resignation. At the same time, the leaders had to make clear to Nixon that they regarded his impeachment and conviction as a foregone conclusion. Then, Nixon might begin to see that resignation was the most attractive way out. He had to come to the conclusion himself. He had to perceive it as his own decision. Haig was perplexed about the family. He had been left with the strong impression that at least David saw the wisdom of resignation. But the president was describing the family as united behind his decision to fight on. Haig called David and asked what the hell was going on. David, still confident that the president would come around, suggested that Haig stay cool. The staff was ignoring too many human factors, he said. Haig and others were focusing narrowly on the legal implications and the incriminating evidence and not considering how the president might react to his situation. If the family were not supportive, it could make it tougher for the president to resign. "We have to show him that he doesn't have to prove anything to us," David said. Any encouragement to resign on their part would imply a devastating moral judgment. He thought that his father-in-law was resisting that moral judgment more than resignation. The family had to show the president that they still loved him, no matter what. Haig was skeptical of amateur psychologizing. "Trust me," David said. "I know what I'm doing." Mr. Nixon could accept political defeat, but he would not allow himself to be condemned morally. At 9 a.m., the strategy group assembled, battered and dispirited. Most of the group, among them Buzhardt, Timmons, Buchanan, and Gergen, were ready to fold up operations. Only Clausen and Kachigian seemed anxious to fight, and they had scarcely an idea on how to proceed. This morning was different from others that had followed damaging Watergate disclosures. There was no organized propaganda campaign. There were no statements, no background briefings, and few meetings. At 10 a.m., St. Clair met with his assistants at McKayhill's suggestion. St. Clair didn't particularly like meetings. He ran them tightly, never allowing the discussion to range over matters that were not immediately at hand. He reacted to his staff cagily, just as he did to outsiders. This morning there was a hint of exasperation and surliness in his voice. As he entered the room, he noticed that one of his assistants, Lauren Smith, who suffered from a bronchial condition, was wearing an asthma mask. "What's your problem?" St. Clair snapped at him. The purpose of the meeting, St. Clair announced, was to tell everyone that the president's plan was to go to trial in the Senate. Everything was to be business as usual. "As for the new evidence, we're going to deal with it like any other problem," St. Clair said. His intention was to find a technical defense. There was no proof whatsoever, he pointed out, that the president knew of the entire cover-up. The same distinction was being made by some of the more militant presidential defenders. There was a little cover-up, the move to slow the FBI probe by using the CIA. and there was the big cover-up, the organized clandestine payment of money to the original Watergate defendants. An argument could be made that the president was only part of the little cover-up. "The president wants to go to trial," St. Clair repeated. As lawyers for the president, they had work to do. The staff filed dutifully out of the office. The cabinet meeting, scheduled for 10 o'clock that morning, had been postponed to 11 because the president was not up at 10. On the hour, Nixon walked into the room and took his seat at the center of the oval table. There wasn't the usual applause. The president's high-backed brown leather chair was slightly taller than the others. Directly in front of him, under the lip of the table which he had donated to the White House, were two spaces for buttons. One button had summoned Haldeman. The other had been marked Butterfield and had activated the taping system in the cabinet room. Now, both Haldeman and the taping system were gone. Kissinger was on Nixon's right, Secretary of Defense Schlesinger at his left. Ford was facing the president across the table and slightly to the left. Stewards served coffee. "I would like to discuss the most important issue confronting this nation," the president began, "and confronting us internationally, too. Inflation." Cabinet members looked about in mild astonishment. But Nixon quickly shifted to what was on everybody's mind. "I want the facts out," he said. He described Watergate as one of the most asinine things that was ever done. "I'll take whatever lumps are involved." He had consulted expert lawyers, and they had told him that there was no obstruction of justice and no impeachable offense. "If there were," he said, "I wouldn't stay in this office one minute. I simply was not tending the store on the domestic side. Because the CIA and the FBI were at loggerheads, I sought to act. You all know I was concerned almost exclusively with national security interests, but I did mention certain political interests. The cabinet has been splendid in standing up. I have been very moved by it. Some, including some good friends, believe it would be best to resign and not go through the ordeal of a Senate trial. Not go through this step, which would relieve me of great personal pressure and change the Constitution that would allow other presidents to be forced out of office. I've considered that, as a matter of fact. It should be considered, but I have had to make a decision. A president is really not in the position of an ordinary citizen on this kind of matter. My view is that I should not take the step that changes the Constitution and sets a precedent for the future. It would be the parliamentary system, with all of its weaknesses and none of its strengths, from my own standpoint and that of my family, something which I have had to consider. I will accept whatever verdict the Senate hands down, recognizing the possibility that the outcome may not be favorable." The president didn't look at anyone as he spoke. HUD Secretary Lynn was watching for a flicker of the eye or nervousness in the hands, some sign that the president was bluffing. He concluded that Nixon was going to fight, or else he was playing the best poker Lynn had ever seen. "I've analyzed the best I can," the president went on. "The best memory I can, buttressed by miles and miles of tape, and I have not found an impeachable offense, and therefore resignation is not an acceptable course. I don't ask any of you to do anything that would be embarrassing to you, your personal interest. All I ask is that you run this government well. I've vetoed $35 billion in appropriations during Watergate. I intend to fight this inflation battle with all the tools we can. It's not been a very easy year or week. I want to do the right thing for the country, for me too, but the other matter comes first. I have a very loyal, competent cabinet. If I resign, it would change the Constitution. Some of you may disagree, I respect that, but I've made my decision. You don't have to talk about Watergate. I suggest that you talk about the good things the administration has done. Watergate will be brought to an end by the constitutional process." He would make all evidence available to the House. "Although I could delay for a month, nothing will be withheld. I don't ask you to get involved in my problems, but it is time to do a bit extra in running the government. If I knew there was an impeachable offense, I would not make the Senate go through the agony of trying to prove it. I've got a hell of a good cabinet.
I will go through this with my head high, right up to the end, if it comes.
Treasury Secretary Simon, sitting across from the president, to Ford's right, felt that the president was beseeching his cabinet to stand up and cheer. But it wasn't going to happen. The silence, Simon thought, was telling the president what he already knew. There would be no clamor that he stay on the job. The president turned to Ford and waited.
"I'm in a difficult position," Ford said. "I share your view that the whole episode is a real tragedy. Nobody has more admiration and affection for you. I made a decision yesterday that because of commitments to Congress and the public, I will have no further comments on the issue, because I am a party in interest."
"Sure. There will be impeachment," Ford said, perhaps too frankly.
"I can't predict the Senate outcome. I will make no comment concerning this. You have given us the finest foreign policy this country has ever had, a super job, and the people appreciate it. I support, without hesitation, your policies on inflation.